Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How were Theodore Roosevelt and William Howard Taft shaped and strengthened by the political alliance and personal friendship that developed before either man controlled the White House? And what stresses eventually brought that warm alliance to a breaking point? A little over a century ago, America was struggling with challenges that sound very familiar to us today. Crippling legislative gridlock, vastly powerful corporations contributing to unprecedented income inequality, and a political system soaked in money. Crusading journalists helped to reveal many of these problems, and leaders like Roosevelt and Taft felt it their duty to correct them. As my guest today will tell us, their respective successes and failures affected the country's welfare and deeply impacted their relationship to one another. Historian Doris Kearns Goodwin tells this story in her new book, The Bully Pulpit: Theodore Roosevelt, William Howard Taft, and the Golden Age of Journalism. She joins us from the studios of WGBH in Boston. Doris, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris. Glad to be with you.
So I love this. You began the project expecting to write about the always compelling Roosevelt. At what point along the way did you discover how fascinating William Howard Taft was in his own right?
Well, I think part of the impulse to expand the cast of characters beyond Roosevelt was the awareness that so many good biographies have been written about him. I'm always drawn to the most interesting characters, which means a lot of other people have been drawn to them as well. Mm. Like Lincoln, I had to surround with his team of rivals, FDR with Eleanor and the home front. So I was looking for a way to go beyond Teddy. And when I began to look into the relationship with William Howard Taft, not only that he had followed him in the presidency in 1908, but then they'd run against each other in 1912, I found there were more than 400 letters between the two men, and that they had become great friends from the time they were in their early 30s, and that Taft had been a central figure in Teddy's cabinet. And then I thought, wow, I don't know anything about this. So I started reading Taft's private letters to his wife and Teddy's letters to Taft and Teddy's letters about him and the private journals. And then suddenly he emerged as a character in his own right.
And as characters, they both conveniently came with really fascinating wives as well.
Not even a question. I mean, and both wives very different from each other, each choosing to understand the era in which she lived and make the most of it in terms of her own needs and wants. Edith Roosevelt had come from a rather crumbling family when she was young. Her father had lost his money. He had once been wealthy, was an alcoholic. So when she married Teddy, what she wanted more than anything was to create a stable family for him and for their children. And as First Lady, she had no interest in being a public figure. She said a woman's name should be in the paper only twice, when she's married and when she's buried. She didn't give political opinions out. She simply created an extraordinarily warm sanctuary home, sort of place for replenishment for Teddy Roosevelt, which he needed with all his manic energy. Nellie Taft, by contrast, as an adolescent in Cincinnati, also growing up in an upper middle class family, wanted from the time she was young to be something more than a domestic partner. She had great ambition. She was very smart. She was teaching in a boys' school. Her mother worried that she wouldn't be in society. She wouldn't get married. And she said, I don't want to get married if it means that it will undo my hopes. Mm. And then she meets young Will Taft, and he not only adores her but promises her that he will be her partner and she will be his. And she really becomes his political strategist. She's the one who wants politics more than he does. She spurs him at every step along the way. And when he finally becomes president, she feels like it's the happiest day in her life and becomes a very activist first lady. Opposite to Edith, she says, I am a public figure, and she's involved with working class women problems. She creates a public park in Washington for free concerts, invites all sorts of people to the White House, brings the cherry trees to Washington. So it's a very different understanding, but they each gave indispensable support to their husbands in different ways.
So tell us about how Taft and Roosevelt met and what drew them together despite such very different personalities and very different leadership styles.
Yeah, it's fun to imagine them physically when they first met because they're both in their early 30s and they lived in the same part of Washington together. Taft was the then Solicitor General and Teddy was civil service commissioner. So they walked to work together. And I can just picture them, actually. I mean, Taft, even then, a big, much bigger guy than Teddy. Teddy talking continually as Taft is listening as they go to work. They were both young reformers. And that meant in that time, in the 1880s, 1890s, that you were against corruption and the political alliance between the bosses and the party's leaders. And as a result, they were probably feeling like there weren't a lot of allies on their part, so they felt drawn to one another, and in some ways their opposite tendencies made them closer. Taft said of Teddy that he admired so much his fiery rhetoric, his ability to speak so easily, and his giving speeches and finding nothing difficult about them, whereas Teddy said of Taft he envied his personality because he was so likable, so amiable, that everybody liked him right away, fell in love with him, actually, whereas with Teddy it took longer, and Teddy couldn't get along with all the people that Taft relentlessly got along with. So it was almost a case of opposites attracting, I think, but they became really good friends.
That's the thing I didn't know about Taft, was that, like, he was this genial figure that everybody loved, because he often, you know, the photographs we've seen of him, everybody focuses on his weight, and he often looks sort of dour when he's presented in images.
Yes, but they say, all the people that knew him at the time, that he had this extraordinary smile that went, in fact, one of his campaign slogans when he ran was "Smile with Taft," although another one was "Get on a raft with Taft," which would be a rather dubious proposition. If you're 350 pounds, you're not going to be on that raft if you're the other person. But yes, I mean, every step along the way, when he was Solicitor General or later Governor General of the Philippines or in Teddy's cabinet as Secretary of War, people adored him. I mean, he was not the kind of person who hogged credit for himself. He gave credit to his superiors. He got along with everybody. It was, I think, a case of the number two person, perfectly number two, but he never loved politics. And you can't be in presidential spotlight without loving politics, loving the fight of it, having malice if you need to. And that's where it grew. It was far short for him.
Both these men were Republicans, or Roosevelt eventually left the Republican Party, but they were Republicans at a time when it wasn't an oxymoron to be a committed progressive and Republican at the same time.
Right. I mean, within the Republican Party, there were two factions, really. And when Roosevelt first became president, when McKinley was shot, the conservative old guard really had control of the Republican Party, and indeed the majority party it was in the Congress. So Roosevelt understood he had already budding progressive thoughts, which really meant at that time that the government had to do something about the problems of the industrial era, that ever since the Civil War, they'd been building the gap between the rich and the poor, and ordinary people being squeezed, these huge monopolies, workmen without compensation, and unsanitary meat plants and drugs that were flooding the market that were no good. And there was no regulation because laissez-faire was so much of a religious conviction. So Teddy began to think that he had to do something or his own Republican Party would be hurt. So the only way to drag the leaders who didn't want to do this in the Congress, his own main leaders, was to put public pressure from the outside in. And that's why he coined the phrase the bully pulpit, that the president has a power in the national platform to educate and mobilize action, and then he pressured the Congress from the outside in.
Take us back to the early 20th century. Tell us about the kinds of social and political and economic problems that had people worried back then in a sort of existential way for the future of the country.
No, you're right. I mean, what had happened, obviously, between the Civil War and the turn of the 20th century was a massive movement from the country to the city. And that brought a lot of difficulties for the nation, because in the country, when you were a farmer, even if things were tough, you still had a certain independence. And now all these immigrants have arrived in the city. People are moving from the country to the city, and they're in jobs where they may not have control over their wages. Prices have gone up. Unions are beginning to get strong, and there's lots of violent strikes going on around the country. There was a fear, actually, of a coming revolution against the rich, because there was so much talk about these corporate bigwigs who were becoming millionaires while ordinary life got more difficult. And the other interesting thing, just in terms of comparison to today, they worried at the turn of the 20th century that the pace of life had sped up immensely, because you obviously had telephones, which you hadn't had before, coming into being. You had railway cars. You had travel changing. You had telegrams instead of long handwritten letters. And the local newspapers were telling you horror stories from all around the world. So people said there was a rise in nervous disorders at the turn of the 20th century. Think about the pace of life today and what that must mean for anxiety. So there was a sense, really, of a country on the edge unless something was done to soften the worst aspects of industrialization.
Of course, you also had for the first time a significant population of literate middle-class Americans who took a keen interest in these issues, even when they themselves were not necessarily directly affected.
That's what really made the progressive movement popular. I mean, it wasn't that it was a movement by the poor against the rich. The middle class simply wanted some rational centrist action in order to soften the worst parts, as I say, and make sure that socialism didn't come into being, because there was a lot of socialist impulse at that time that said, if this isn't working and you can't get government regulation in a centrist way, then let's just take over the railroads, take over the public utilities. And as a result, the middle class really took a leadership position. And they were literate. They were in these magazines, the journalists who reached out to that middle class. And it was, in many ways, a middle class revolution.
Tell us about McClure's magazine, because some of the behind the scenes stories you have here are just astonishing, especially given the media climate that we have today.
Well, the first way I began to learn about the importance of this magazine, when I read the best historians, as you do at the beginning, the secondary historians on the Progressive Era, they kept talking about this one magazine, McClure's, that was almost as important in the Progressive Movement as Theodore Roosevelt himself was. And then when I realized that the journalists that I knew about from history, Ida Tarbell, Lincoln Steffens, Ray Baker, William Allen White, were all there at the same time in the same place, I decided to look into the magazine's history. And it turned out that the founder, this extraordinarily interesting character, Sam McClure, who was probably a manic depressive, flights of genius and then long periods of depression, created a magazine that he deliberately wanted to be a mission for the good. So he almost created the concept of a staff reporter, bringing all these people on, promising them salaries for a couple years even before they had to write a word in order to really do investigations that would stand up, that would be fact-based. So Ida Tarbell was given lots of time and resources to study how Standard Oil had developed through a biography of John D. Rockefeller, showing the unfair illegal means that had been used to gain his monopoly position. Lincoln Steffens was sent out to the cities to show the corruption between the political bosses and the criminal world and the business world. And Ray Baker studied the railroad inequities. And together, those reports really became common conversations in the country. They were sometimes 20, 30, 40, 50,000 words long.
Wow.
People are gobbling them up, and they're all talking about it because they were all in the form of stories. And people can always, I think, relate to stories rather than facts and figures. And then those people then got mobilized to say, along with Teddy, we have to do something about these problems.
Is it going too far to say that Roosevelt used some journalists almost as de facto policy advisors?
No, I don't think it is going too far. I mean, what's extraordinary about his relationship with the press, he respected them, number one, because he was a fellow writer. So he would read all of their articles, even before they came out, sometimes in proof. And he had a relationship with these people that somehow they were able to retain their integrity, which meant they could continue to criticize him, even as they gave him advice and he leaned on them. And he could criticize them if he thought they were impractical in their remedies, because they were usually further ahead than he was. I mean, the famous case of that is when one of the journalists wrote a review of his book about the Rough Rider experience in the Spanish-American War, and in which he said that, mocking him, that it seemed as if he was so important in the war, he might have called the book Alone in Cuba, as if he were the only person there. Instead of getting angry, what does Roosevelt do? He writes a letter to the journalist saying, I regret to tell you my family is delighted with the review of my book. Now you owe me something. I've always wanted to meet you. Come east the next time. He was in Chicago, the guy. Mm. So that's what made it work, so that it wasn't a co-optation. But it takes an unusual leader, I think, and an unusual press corps to make that happen.
My guest is historian Doris Kearns Goodwin. Her new book is called The Bully Pulpit, Theodore Roosevelt, William Howard Taft, and the Golden Age of Journalism. You can join the conversation now by calling in to 1-800-933-5372, sending me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think, or sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this January to design your own Master's of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, human rights, creative writing, and others. More at smu.edu/mls.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with historian Doris Kearns Goodwin. Her new book is called The Bully Pulpit, Theodore Roosevelt, William Howard Taft, and the Golden Age of Journalism. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So Doris, Roosevelt, of course, became president upon the assassination of William McKinley. How active had he been as vice president during those years?
He hated being vice president. Indeed, the reason he ended up as vice president was that as governor of New York, he had come into runnings against the political bosses of the state, trying to be a reform governor. So they decided the best thing to do was to elevate him to this vice presidency where he would do nothing at all. Mm. And in fact, the vice presidency was so unimportant at that time that he was thinking of going back and finishing law school because he had nothing to do. And he felt really like his talents weren't being used, and there was a depression that was settling over him. And then, of course, the kaleidoscope shifts, and McKinley is assassinated in September of 01. And suddenly, this man the political bosses did not want had become president of the United States.
And so he is sort of, he sets to work with great energy. Can you talk about his most important goals?
I think what he mostly wanted was two things. One was to do something to break up the large monopolies, which were getting stronger year after year after year, and really swallowing up small business. And two, he realized that there had to be some economic regulation of some of the corporations. Just opening their books to public inspection, preventing corporate campaign contributions to political campaigns, and mostly doing things about workmen's compensation, child labor, women in the factories, things that would make easier the life after the industrial era. But he had to move slowly at first because he knew that he had to seem like he was still following McKinley and only gradually work into really presenting these reform proposals to the Congress, which he did over time.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Let's go on the phone to Terry in Fort Worth. Hello, Terry.
Hi. How are you? How are you guys doing today?
Very well. Thank you.
I just have a question. It seems to me that there are so many parallels now between that time and our time now because, we deregulated advertising for doctors and lawyers in the 80s, and we saw what that did to medical costs. And all you really have to do is look at Glass-Steagall, okay? We repealed Glass-Steagall, and we almost had a Great Depression again. And I'm just wondering, you know, with all of this polarization, where is our new TR going to come from?
That's a wonderful question, and I think it's one that the country itself may be asking because of the, you know, just the sense of paralysis in the Congress not being able to deal in any way with what's going on, which was what Roosevelt faced at first. And there's probably a reason why it seems parallel today than to before. Two reasons, maybe. One is that the industrial era had created the problems that needed solution, just as our digital era and the technological revolution, I think, has created these huge billionaires side by side with companies that have gotten bigger and bigger and ordinary people feeling more squeezed. But you're dead right. I think what was the issue at the turn of the 20th century was what is the role of government in keeping things on an equal basis, in a fair basis. I mean, what Teddy was talking about was a square deal. I'm not going to be against corporations, he said, if they're doing right, but if they're doing wrong, I'm going after them. I'm not going to be against unions unless they're doing wrong. And he had always a sense, really, of a centrist action. But obviously, we've seen in the last 30 years a massive deregulation of the regulations that were passed in an earlier time. And we saw the problems when Glass-Steagall, in particular, was undone, when you allow people to not have that public sense of what's necessary. And yet the difficulty in talking now about the role of government is probably as difficult as it was at the turn of the 20th century because people don't believe in the same way in government as Teddy was able to make them believe because we've had experiences with it, the wars that people may not have found popular, a sense of the budget overruns. And unless that faith that public power can help to the problems of the society returns, it's going to be very hard for a leader to mobilize the public because he needs that faith in the public's part.
How did Taft and Roosevelt continue to work together once Roosevelt was in the White House?
Well, once Roosevelt was in the White House, Taft was still in the Philippines as Governor General, where he'd done a quite remarkable job, even though he'd been against the occupation in the first place. He did at least a decent job in making the Filipino people think he had their interests at large, even though the occupation itself may have been wrong in the first place. So Taft is brought back to Teddy's cabinet as Secretary of War, but he's much more than that. He becomes his main troubleshooter, his advisor on questions of union and capital, unions and capital. He travels around the country supporting Teddy in 1904 in a time when presidents weren't supposed to campaign on their own behalf during Teddy's main election. And when Teddy was out of the country, as he often was, or out of Washington, he would be the acting president. And somebody said to Teddy when he was going away on a big whistle-stop tour or a hunting trip, what are you going to do? What's the country going to do in your absence? He says, oh, don't worry. I've left Taft sitting on the lid. And then, of course, these huge cartoons of the rather big Taft sitting on the lid of domestic problems. So he really was, I think, his most important advisor during those presidential years, which is why Teddy chose him, handpicked him, really, as his successor in 1908.
Why did Taft have the opportunity to run in 1908? There were no term limits for the president at the time. It seems that Roosevelt made a rather impulsive statement.
Without a question. I mean, Roosevelt, what had happened is he took office in 1901 when McKinley's killed. He wins election big in 1904. And at that moment of victory, he announces that he would have served 7.5 years by the end of that term. And he respected the wise custom of a two-term tradition. He later said he would have cut out his tongue or cut his hand at the wrist to not make that statement because he loved being president. Mm-hmm. And he would have won easily in 1908. He was an extraordinarily popular president. I mean, he was one of the people that the presidents seemed intimate to the public. They called him Teddy. I mean, teddy bears are named after him. You know, everywhere he goes, there are people holding their teddy bears. It's as if they knew their presidents, partly because it's the new age of mass newspapers, the new age of photography, much more cartoons. There were constant cartoons about Teddy with his big teeth and his spectacles and his fiery language. And he made a comment once. He said, I don't understand it. The more these funny cartoons appear, the more popular I become. And I think the reason was that they were all good-natured because he was so colorful, so magnetic, so full of nervous energy that the people really loved him. And so if he had not made that decision, there would have been no Taft. The whole country might have been different if there had been a third Roosevelt term.
And, of course, even 1 3/4 Roosevelt terms were, he was a tough act to follow for Taft.
It would have been for anybody. In fact, it would have been a tough act for Teddy himself to follow because the rupture within the Republican Party had already begun to deepen because the Eastern establishment, it was the big issue at the time, which may seem really boring to us now, but was huge at the time, was the tariff. And the Eastern people wanted high protection for their manufacturing goods. The Western farmers needed low tariffs because they were paying too much for ordinary goods. And that had begun to widen. Teddy was wise enough, but not brave at all, in not taking on the issue. And then Taft takes on the issue, and it inevitably split the party even more.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Alan in Fort Worth. Hi, Alan.
Hi.
Hi, go right ahead.
It's a great show, Chris. I really enjoy it.
Thank you.
I appreciate that. And an interesting guest today. I'd like to find out what the author's recommendation is for U.S. administration and press relationships as they go on, presently, more from the angle of the not so much the stagnant Congress, as you mentioned earlier, but the bipolarity between news outlets and how that kind of plays into the relations with the administration.
Thanks for your call.
No, it's a wonderful question, and I think it's an important one because what happened in the 20th century, if you look at Teddy Roosevelt's time, when he would give a speech, it might be reported in full in the newspapers, and then he would capture the headlines with his fiery, folksy language. Even through FDR, when he's on the radio, everybody is listening. 80-85% of the adult radio audiences are listening. Saul Bellow said you could walk down the street on a hot Chicago night and not miss a word of what Roosevelt was saying because every kitchen, every living room had it on, and you could hear that same voice everywhere. In the early days of television, really from JFK up to Reagan, if you gave a speech, it would be on one of the three networks, and the speech would be delivered whole, and then they might go back to ordinary programming. But now, as your question suggests, you might just be listening to a president like President Obama trying to use the bully pulpit now about the health care law. You might just be listening to your favorite cable network. You might only hear part of the speech. You'll hear the pundits criticizing it even before it's done. And our attention span is so limited that it's hard to get a common conversation on any topic going long enough to sustain interest to do something about it, because breaking news breaks in even before you finish the speech. So I think the power of the bully pulpit has been diminished. But it doesn't mean that it's still not important for a president to use it, and I think to develop better relations with the press. As annoying as those relationships may be, as irritating, our best presidents, including FDR and Teddy and perhaps Reagan, were able to develop relationships with the press that allowed them to reach the country and use the press to understand what is happening in the country at large.
So Taft, as you tell us, got mired in this very complicated and controversial issue of tariffs. There was fracturing within the Republican Party. I wonder if there were also sort of temperamental issues that kept him from feeling like a good fit once he sat in the Oval Office.
Without a question. I mean, I think temperament is the big separator in leadership, particularly for the presidency. And Teddy Roosevelt was meant from the time he was young and joined the state legislature right after Congress to love politics, to love the disputes in it, to love the fiery nature of it, even attacking opponents and making allies. Taft had always wanted from the time he was out of college to be a judge. That was his dream, and he had a temperament perfectly suited for it. He was fair. He was deliberative. It took him time to make decisions, but you had time. When you made those decisions as a judge, you didn't have to explain them to the public. He never liked giving public speeches. Suddenly, he's in the vortex of politics, and he's in the public spotlight. Instead of being the number two guy, he's the number one guy. And he himself said, "I feel like a fish out of water." The only thing that might have made his presidency different, it's one of those great as-if questions. His wife, Nellie, had loved politics from the time she was a young girl, and she was really smart, strategically smart. She had paved his way every step along the way. She was a very activist first lady in her first few months in office. She was a great advisor to him. He did pretty well in those first couple of months, and then she had a devastating stroke, and she was never able to speak and connecting languages again, even though she was only 49 years old. She could only be taught to say, "glad to see you" or "happy you're here." Taft spent hours with her trying to get her to say those words so she could be at receptions. It was devastating to him. I mean, one of his aides said he looked like a great stricken animal. So it's hard to know from history. What if Nellie had lived as a partner and been able to deal with him? And more importantly, so much of his time was spent with her rather than on the office duties, so his presidency inevitably fell short.
It's really hard to imagine having a job with that much professional stress and responsibility and having such a crisis at home.
Me too. I mean, you know, when suddenly this woman who he adored his entire life and who he talked with his entire life, and everything came back to her. I mean, she was able to walk again, even though she'd originally been paralyzed. She could read and write, but something had happened in the brain that didn't allow her to say sentences in any meaningful way. They could sort of understand what she was saying, but in public, she had lost this forum that she had used so brilliantly. And it's hard to imagine what it must have been like for him. You're right. And then itself, when the presidency becomes complicated through the tariff reform and he starts getting attacked by the press, and he'd never really been attacked before, hadn't withstood adversity as most of our great presidents have before they get it, then he really did have a terribly sad time as president.
So how did Roosevelt, before he announced that he would actually run for the GOP nomination in 1912, how did he begin to express his disapproval of Taft's handling of the presidency?
Well, what happens very early on, he goes to Africa, Roosevelt does, and partly to give space to Taft so that he knew that he was such a popular figure that if he were hanging around, it would be difficult, but also partly because he knew he was sad leaving the presidency, so he had to put himself into something where he'd be active every moment as he was on his safari. But then his progressive friends came over to Europe when he came out of Africa before he came back to America and told him that Taft had betrayed his legacy by cozying up too much to the old guard in Congress in order to get this tariff reform bill passed, which was very disappointing to the progressives. Even though it was better than it had been there before, better than anything Teddy had done, it wasn't enough for the progressives. So he comes back already feeling some sense of distrust. And then he goes to New York, and a million people are waiting in a huge parade for him, so happy to have him back. An astonishing outcry. Teddy bears hanging all over the big buildings and Teddy signs everywhere. And I think it just engendered in him the desire again, I've missed this, I really want it. So intermixed are these progressives telling him, we need you as the champion banner. And at the same time, he wants it himself. So he just begins moving slowly away from Taft, not going to the White House when Taft invited him, being cold when the two of them met, which was heartbreaking for Taft. And luckily for historians, there was a military aide who had been Teddy's military aide, so close to Teddy that Teddy thought of him as another son, and very close then staying on with Taft, who wrote daily letters to his family. And he illustrated what Taft was feeling with each one of these little ruptures getting deeper and deeper. It was heartbreaking for Taft because he had loved Teddy Roosevelt.
So what was the primary contest like in 1912?
It was brutal. I mean, I think what happened is, so Teddy decides that he will challenge Taft for the Republican nomination. And this was the beginning of the primaries. Before that, conventions were choosing the nominees. Mm-hmm. But he knew his only chance was to have, because Taft had control of the convention, you had to get the primaries. So Teddy won most of the primary states where people could vote. But the anger that he showed toward Taft was bigger than he could possibly have really felt. He said that Taft had the brain of a guinea pig. He knew that wasn't true. He dealt with him for years. He said he was a puzzle wit, you know, that. And then Taft said of Teddy that he was a danger to the Republic. If he had a third term, he'd want a fourth and a fifth. It was almost as if they had to ratchet it up in order to understand how they were going against their friends. And then you get to the Republican convention. Teddy still thinks he has a good chance to win, and it was pretty close, but Taft had control of the machinery. And when he wins, Teddy then stomps out of the convention and forms his third party, the Bull Moose Party. And then by that time, Teddy really focuses on the Democratic contestant, Woodrow Wilson, more than Taft, because it was clear that it was between Teddy and Wilson. So the rhetoric between Teddy and Taft softens, but everybody sort of knows that it's going to be almost impossible for either one of those two to win if the Republican Party is split in two, as it was.
Were Roosevelt and Taft in communication during this time?
No. They were not in any communication after having all those years of closeness. Nothing happened. And, in fact, they just, you know, talked against each other on the campaign trail, and it got worse and worse and worse. And then they both lose in November of 1912. And even after that, I just didn't want to end the book on that rupture between them, knowing how strong their friendship had once been. So I decided to follow their relationship between 1912 and 1919 when Teddy Roosevelt died. And at first, friends tried to bring them together, and that bitterness was still there.
Let me
so
jump in for a
long time,
because we have to take a quick break, and I want to be able to get to this story and give it its full justice. So hold on just 1 minute. My guest is historian Doris Kearns Goodwin. Her new book is called The Bully Pulpit: Theodore Roosevelt, William Howard Taft, and the Golden Age of Journalism. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this January to design your own Master's of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, human rights, creative writing, and others. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is historian Doris Kearns Goodwin. Her new book is called The Bully Pulpit: Theodore Roosevelt, William Howard Taft, and the Golden Age of Journalism. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. And Doris, before the break, you were saying that friends tried to bring these two old friends back together without success. I suppose the one thing ultimately they could agree on was that they both thought that Woodrow Wilson was botching the lead up to the First World War.
You know, you're absolutely right. I mean, I think that common sense of an enemy out there, the Democrat who wasn't preparing America quickly enough for the war, partly brought them back together. And at a certain point, Teddy had an operation in a hospital, and it was the same operation Taft had had one time before. So he wrote him a note, you know, saying he knew what he was going through and he'd had that pain. And then Teddy wrote him back, breaking the ice a little bit. But then finally what happened is in 1918, only the year before Teddy died, they were both, it turned out, coincidentally, in the Blackstone Hotel in Chicago. Teddy was there having dinner. Taft came in, was going up in the elevator to his room, and the elevator operator said, Roosevelt is in the dining room having dinner. So Taft said, well, take me downstairs immediately. He went into the dining room. There's 100 diners there. He goes over to Teddy's table, and he throws his arms around him. Teddy says, sit down. And the entire audience broke out in applause because they knew that it meant they'd finally gotten back together. And Teddy said to a reporter that night who happened to be there, that's how we know the applause happened, that he was so glad this had happened, that it was splendid of Taft to come over. And then Only 8 months later or so, Teddy died at the age of 60 of a sudden embolism. In fact, the vice president said the only way he could have died was in his sleep, because otherwise there would have been a fight with death. And Taft then was invited to the private funeral at Teddy's. He stayed at the grave longer than anybody else, and he told the sister that, thank God they had gotten together, he would have mourned it all his life if they had died in a hostile state toward one another. But it took those long 6 years for the bitterness of that 1912 thing to begin to fade.
I have to tell you, Doris, I choked up when I read the story. I choked up just now when you told it. It's just such a great reunion. And the idea that all these, you know, essentially strangers are pulling for these two to get back together is pretty extraordinary.
No, that's right. I mean, part of the pulling together was the Republican Party wanting these two people to come together so that the progressives would come back in the Republican Party. But much more of it was that people knew how close they had once been, how sad it was for both of them. And at first, I guess it was just too close to the brutality of that campaign. And Taft said even though they met a couple times when people brought them together, it seemed like armed neutrality. They couldn't break through the hurt from that election. But then finally, at this point, they did. And I think both of them were so glad that it had happened.
The story also makes you think of what we do as a country with presidents who remain, you know, fairly interested in politics. And Roosevelt was quite young, actually, when he died, but who become president at a young age. And I thought about, you know, sort of the revival of Bill Clinton. And it seems to me, just watching from a distance, that maybe he would ache to get back into politics. But of course, that's impossible.
Right. I mean, it's wonderfully interesting to realize that Teddy at one point, way early, said he shuddered to think of what it would be like if he were an ex-president. He was hardly president at the time. And he just knew that somehow to be hanging around, it's got to be really hard. I mean, if you've been in that office, and especially if you loved it, as Clinton did, as Teddy did, and you love exercising your talents and feeling like you're using them to the fullest extent, and you just get accustomed to what it's like to be president. I mean, it's much different today because Clinton's still surrounded by a lot of hoopla because that's our modern presidency. But I remember when Eisenhower was no longer president, he had had people who had been monitoring his calls ever since he was general. So he goes back home and he picks up the phone and he hears this buzz sound. And he says to somebody, "What's that buzzing sound?" And somebody had to tell, "That's a dial tone, Mr. President." So they're pretty unused to normal living after that. But I think our country needs to make better use of our ex-presidents because, I mean, I think President Bush has been very classy, staying away from politics and, you know, seemingly being happy at his place in Texas and writing a very good memoir. And not interfering. But on the other hand, there's so much advice that they could each give to one another. A book was written about the President's Club. Nobody else knows what it's like to be president but a president. And you almost wish that they could form a shadow cabinet from different parties and really help the president in power more than they do.
You have to imagine there's a great sympathy that they have and empathy for one another, even if their politics are quite different.
I think that's right. I mean, certainly President Bush and George Bush Sr., I know, when they were trooping around doing various fundraisers for various disasters, I think really did become friends. And it makes sense. I mean, it makes sense because the pressures on that office, despite the pleasures of it and the difficulties of it, only they can understand. So I think it's a good thing when they do get together.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Gary in Denison. Hi, Gary.
Hi.
Hi, Gary.
Another wonderful show. I had a question for Ms. Goodwin. The antitrust gains that had been made after Roosevelt for the insurance industry were reversed in 1934 with the McCarran-Ferguson Act, which basically exempted all insurance from antitrust laws in the United States, current to this day. And given that the health insurance exchanges can still use these, are still exempt, not held to antitrust laws. I was wondering what Ms. Goodwin thought of that, or if I had my perspective wrong, or what her thoughts are.
Well, thanks for your call, Gary. Go ahead,
Doris. Wonderful question, and I'm afraid I haven't thought about it much, but I will now give it some thought, because I think what's really a fine line is what kind of antitrust in what sectors are essential. And Roosevelt would argue that it has nothing to do with bigness. It was simply if the company was using unfair means to create a monopoly, which meant that it could exact higher prices or shut other businesses out. other people thought bigness itself was a problem, which is what Woodrow Wilson thought. And even Taft, I think, to some extent thought that. So the question over time from the decades that followed Roosevelt's time was which industries are in danger of forming a monopoly and which industries are helped by antitrust being weakened. Certainly during World War II, Roosevelt, FDR, decreased antitrust regulation because he needed these companies working together to produce the ships, the tanks, the weapons, and the planes. But sometimes then you produce problems when you reduce it. So I don't know the actual answer to the health insurance thing. It's a fascinating question, and I'd love to know more about it.
Why do we know Taft as William Howard Taft in a way that not every president is known by his three names?
I don't know. Now I've gotten two questions that I better find the answer to. I mean, I always call him William Howard Taft, and I'm not even sure why, because I don't even know now. Oh, my God. Now that I think about it, I don't even know where the Howard comes from. I mean, here I've lived with this guy for 7 years, and I forgot to ask him this important question. I've met Governor Taft's relatives, actually, President Taft's relatives, and the names that were his brothers are everywhere, Horace and Charlie and Will. And Howard, you've now, this is very, very interesting. And of course, he became WHT, you know, as LBJ was LBJ or JFK. It seems like in modern times, we've used that middle name even more. But I will find out about Howard, who he is, where he came from, and why he was called William Howard Taft. Oh, and I do it myself, like 20 times in the book.
I'm going to have to follow up on this then with you and check that out. I understand that there is already interest in potentially licensing this for the big screen. And, of course, many people are aware that your book, Team of Rivals, was the foundation for that amazing film, Lincoln.
Well, what happened is during the time when I was able to be involved with the making of the Lincoln movie, and Spielberg was so generous in really making me part of a team, I took Daniel Day-Lewis to Springfield, Illinois, when he first agreed to be Lincoln, to show him the various Lincoln sites, and I went down to the filming in Richmond. I was able to see all the drafts that Tony Kushner wrote. So during that period of knowing Steven Spielberg, I talked to him about what I was doing on Teddy and Taft, and he read it in manuscript form, then read it in page proofs, and then finally read the book. So he has indeed optioned it for a movie. So what would be so much fun for me is it was such a great adventure to be part of a team as you are in a movie. When you're writing, you're so solitary. Mm-hmm. So if I could be part of this team again in making a movie about these two characters, it would be a great, great honor.
It is always such a pleasure to read your books, Doris, and I think in part because you do sort of set the scene for us. Do you think of yourself as thinking cinematically, not necessarily with the intention of creating the foundation for a film, but do you? What is in your head when you are finding a way to translate facts into a story that we will all get drawn into?
I think the most important thing is to get as many as I can of the person's own voices down through their diaries, through handwritten letters, through private journals. In the old days, oral storytellers before the age of print used to pass down wisdom and counsel from one generation to another, sitting around a fire and telling stories from the past. And I think of myself primarily as a storyteller. So to the extent I can use their actual voices and quote them or quote the newspapers, I mean, I quote all the time because I'd rather say what the newspaper said than me paraphrasing what it said. So those primary sources are key. And then if you can get those primary sources when you're describing a speech, for example, that Roosevelt made, the newspapers will describe the setting of the speech, what the people were yelling at. You know, some of the times it was almost like football games. They'd say, hit him again, harder, harder. And that just gives you an atmosphere so that hopefully you can catapult the reader back into that moment and live with the people. I want them to live with them. Barbara Tuchman, who was a great historian, once said, when you're telling a story, it has to be a beginning, a middle, and an end. Don't let the reader know what's going to happen later so that they can feel sad when these people fall apart or when they die because they've been living with them day by day.
It is nice that there's, at least professionally, there is a happy ending for Taft.
There is great pleasure in the fact that in 1921, he finally gets his dream come true and becomes Chief Justice of the Supreme Court and lives the last decade of his life, he said, at the happiest time of his life. In fact, the day he got to be Chief Justice, he said, this is the happiest day I've ever had. And he was actually, in terms of an administrator, a pretty good Chief Justice when he had to retire from the court because his heart was giving way at the end. They sent him a wonderful letter, all the other justices on the court, saying how much they would miss him. That's where his amiability and his kindly nature and his fairness really could play out in administering a court with these other justices.
Do you think Roosevelt made a mistake in running for that third term, sort of trying to take back power from Taft?
I do. I mean, I think if he had not run, he could have probably easily have run and won in 1916, because Taft would have been, he wouldn't have been running against a sitting president. Wilson almost lost the race to Charles Evans Hughes, the Republican, who was nowhere near as popular as was Teddy Roosevelt. So if he had waited four more years, I think it could have been his. He would have then been the person who implemented World War I. I mean, history would have been changed fundamentally. So I think La Follette, who was one of Roosevelt's rivals, because he was the more progressive than Roosevelt, said he just thought that he couldn't wait because he loved the applause too much. And when he went out on the road and people are yelling, Teddy, 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 it got into him too much. So I think clearly it was a mistake on his part.
It is funny to think about Roosevelt. He was such a prolific writer. People may not remember this today. Someone who loved the spotlight so much had to have put a lot of hours in, you know, behind a closed door alone with his typewriter.
He made more use of every minute, I think, of anybody I've ever studied. I mean, when he knew he had to write an article or give a speech, he would start it right away so he wouldn't worry. Think of how many times when we procrastinate, you worry about the thing you haven't done.
Right.
He never, ever did that. He would read a book while he was waiting for the next visitor in the White House, while he was waiting for his wife to come down the stairs. He wrote 40 books. You know, and as somebody, he said about himself, I'm an ordinary person with extraordinary perseverance. I go hard at everything I do. And that's the key to him in some ways. He said, I'm not a world-class, I've become a world-class birder, but I'm not a, I don't have good eyesight. He became a big game hunter and he wasn't a good shot. He said, I slave over every writing, but I've written 40 books, several of which were quite distinguished. So he just knew how to make use of time. When I think of what would he be like in our distracted time today, if he were as focused today as he was back then without all of our distractions, he'd be way ahead of us all.
He would have no Twitter account is what you're saying.
Well, I don't know. He'd be so good at it, though, because he was so good in shorthand, you know, speak softly and carry a big stick, the square deal. Or he even gave Maxwell House the slogan, good to the very last drop. In fact, I think he drank a lot of coffee a day. Something has to explain this incredible energy that he had.
Does any of his writing hold up today if we just want to read it for pleasure? Is there a particular text you'd recommend?
I would take his nature texts. I mean, where he's really quite lyrical, when he's writing about, you know, wildlife, when he's writing about hunting, when he's writing about the Badlands, when he went out there after his first wife died, there's something about his deep solace that he finds from nature, and of course the founder of the conservation movement in the national parks. That's the best of his writing, in my judgment.
Do you miss these guys now that you're done with this project?
I do. I mean, what happens each time I'm done, I feel like I'm betraying the one who I'm leaving behind, because when I finished FDR, I had to move his books out of my study to make room for Lincoln. Then I had to move Lincoln away to make room for Teddy and Taft. And you do feel odd not waking up with him in the morning. The great thing about the Lincoln movie was I was able to live with Lincoln well beyond the finishing of the book. And he came alive in Daniel Day-Lewis. So we'll see what happens. Maybe if Teddy and Taft become characters, then they can stay in my life a little longer.
The new book by historian Doris Kearns Goodwin is called The Bully Pulpit, Theodore Roosevelt, William Howard Taft, and the Golden Age of Journalism. She joined us today from the studios of WGBH in Boston. Doris, it's been such a pleasure to have you with us.
Oh,
thank
for
you.
Me too, Chris. Thank you so much.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer and Christine McConnell prepares our podcast. Jeff Whittington is the show's executive producer. You can contact us via email at any time at think@kera.org and find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.